All right, council, we're going to go ahead and get started at 7:00 on Tuesday, January 7th, beginning at the Spearfish Community Recreation Center. We will start with a pledge led by Councilmember Geddes and a petition led by Councilmember Ellsberg.
Johnny, please rise.
Pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right, may Father, for the opportunity to meet as a council this evening to discuss the issues that are before us for the city. Please help us to voice decisions, to have listening here, and bless that our spirit can be here so we all be able to communicate our thoughts and do that without us to in meeting the city. For this opportunity, we say since the last time just pressed on.
Thank you. Moving on to item number two is an approval of the meeting's agenda. If someone would like to make that motion.
I move that we approve the agenda for January 7th, 2020.
Motion made by Councilmember Miller, is there a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Councilmember Geddes, all those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Moving on to item number three is our public comment portion of our meeting. And so during this time, as I call you up, each person who wants to speak during public comment will have 3 minutes to do so. Please start with your name and address. And then as I call you, I will just ask if you would like to speak during public comment or during a specific item on the agenda. So the first one I have is Sherry Condi. Did you want to speak now or during that item on the agenda?
Are we able to address that item at the time it's on your agenda?
One or the other, yes.
Oh, we can tell them.
Okay, sounds good. Les Nielsen?
Yes.
Do you want to do it now or during the item?
Excuse me?
Do you want to speak during public comment or do you want to wait until we're speaking about a particular item?
I can speak in public comment.
Okay, come on up.
My name is Les Nielsen. I'm a resident of Cedar Hills. My address is 4260 West White Pine Trail. What I wish to address deals with the driving range. And there are three things I wish to address. First, I want to give the mayor 3 copies of the legal research I did on errant golf balls. I am retired clerk of council for Texaco and Chevron and Cimarex Energy. The point maker that I've given the mayor speaks to the law and facts on liability respecting errant golf balls associated with the driving range. Now, the research I did not use Lexis or Westlaw, just used the internet. So it's possible there's some authority in Utah, which I'm aware of. But as I researched this, neither the law nor the facts paint a pretty picture for the city in the event that the city fails to raise an estimate of what. Serious injury to persons or property could result in both actual and punitive damages. I raise the punitive damage issue because if the city negligently fails to act, having been advised of a dangerous condition. And that's basically the essence of my comments. There's more to detail there. You can share that with the city's attorneys and with the councilmen. And if you have any questions, I can be reached.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The next person on the list is David White.
Oh wait, till 14th, yeah.
14th. Jeff Lindstrom.
I
Jeff Lindstrom, 10469 North Mesquite, right by the driving range. Maybe you'd like to address for a moment the driving range. I've been involved with it since I moved there 3 years ago, and we've been dealing with the errant golf ball issue since then. My comment is that I know we had new holes put in, and that's great, but they're still, in my opinion, not tall enough. The amount of golf balls we receive has gone down, but they're still there. I walk around the park most summer nights, and it's not uncommon to see five or six along the sidewalk along that cotton there. I still get them in my yard, not as many as before, but I still get them. I pulled up to the stop sign, not recently because it's going, but a little earlier on, and turned the corner from Mesquite to Cottonwood, ball hit the side of my truck. And when I walk around the park, I've had two or three incidences where they bounce in the vicinity. So I just want to make aware that the problem's not gone away. And although I appreciate the new polls and that, I don't know if there was much study done into the height on it. 10 minutes on the internet tells me they probably should have been shaped a little different, maybe a little taller in the middle to catch more balls. So I'd maybe recommend that the city looks into a little bit of analysis on what they really need there. Totally unrelated, I drive to work every day going down Cedar Hills Drive, trying to make a left-hand turn onto the down by Walmart, and I was wondering if the city's thought about extending that left turn lane. You get about two cars in there, and they're backed up, holding up traffic. And it looks like a pretty inexpensive thing the city could address down in the next budget cycle, and maybe take out a little bit of there and get a little more cars to go after.
Turning left onto North High Boulevard?
Yes.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Jason Hart.
I'll wait till
14. Okay. Cookie Hart. I live at 10483 North Mesquite Way. I'm actually going to read an email for someone that wasn't connecting tonight. Brad Miller lives at 4181 West Joshua Lane. It says, hi Jenny, thanks for your reply. A couple of items I'd like to respond to. I would disagree. The nets now are the same height as the old ones. From the pictures I find on the internet and Google Earth look to me that the new nets, with my rough calculations, seem about 40 to 45 feet tops above the ground. The original nets seemed roughly 30 feet, August of 2012. The extended height seemed to be 50 feet sometime after 2016. Is there an analysis or installation drawing that shows what the actual comparison is? I believe even the small height difference can explain the increased large amount of balls in the skate now. Although this new fence does not extend to the original length, near the fire hydrant, I don't think that it has anything to do with the increased number of errant golf balls. Jason Hart recently informed me that there is another idea on the table about installing fencing similar to that on the first hole that guards the trail path on the sidewalk along the south side of Cottonwood Drive adjacent to the driving range. This obviously would protect people walking on that part of the sidewalk, but would not solve the entire problem, specifically cars and people at adjacent areas of Mesquite Park. I would not agree this is a proper solution, aesthetics included. Something more realistic would be to study which sections of the fence the balls are escaping over and extend each of those sections another 20 to 40 feet, maybe 30 to 40 more feet for each of those sections. It seems only 5 to 7 poles would need to be extended and possibly would capture 99% of the problem. Something needs to be done since the new fencing, there are way more errant golf balls than in the past. We need to just correct the entire problem. Thanks, Brett. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, Jason Hart. Jeff Bostra.
I'm going out. It's $5 every night. I wouldn't fall with what you guys are. So I'm Jeff Bostra. I live on 10530 North Doral Drive. And my purpose for here coming here is for number 14 as well. And my main concern is the park itself. So I have three kids that we've coached soccer teams, and on more than one occasion we've found golf balls near the pavilion, on that north soccer field, and that's obviously obviously concerning, and up to the point where I've told my kids not to get anywhere near the pavilion. And we definitely stay away from the north soccer field. I mean, there's, and I'm surprised that the guys from that soccer club that's out there all the time, I can't remember who it is, but you know who it is, that they haven't voiced their concerns about golf balls as well. I have a sister that lives on Coppa Drive, so we have lots of walks back and forth from our neighborhood to theirs, and on multiple occasions we're dodging golf balls that have come over the nets, as well as coming past the nets on the east side. So it's a concern. I don't believe that putting fencing is going to stop the biggest concern that I have, which is the north park. Kids should be able to be feel free and safe to play at the parks. And at this point in time, as a parent, I definitely don't feel like my kids are safe to do that. So thank you. Have a good day.
Thank you. Ken Hazelbaker.
I'll wait. Okay.
That is everybody on the list. Is there anybody else that's here today that wanted to speak during public comment and not a specific item? Okay. Then we'll close the public comment portion of our meeting and move on to the consent agenda. These are minutes from the November 19th, 2019 and December 3rd, 2019 council meetings and the appointment of John Dredge, Jared Anderson, Eric Schroeder, and Lorianne Spears of the Planning Commission. If somebody wants to make that motion,
I'll make that motion that we approve the consent agenda.
Motion made by Councilmember Anderson. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Seconded by Councilmember Miller. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. We'll move on to items 6 and 7, which are city reports and business, starting with Mr. Gibbler.
Yes, thank you, Mayor. Just a few quick items. Our junior jazz season has kicked off this week. We have 1,063 participants. We're excited about that. That is down 80 from last year, but it actually should be more manageable given our limited court availability. Our ski bus, we've heard it announced in these meetings before, that is full as well. We've changed to Brighton and we're doing 4 ski nights weekends instead of 3. And then our karate classes kicked off this week with 35 registrants, so we're excited about that. One final announcement is a reminder about snow removal. This last weekend, we did have a snow event, and we did have over 112 citations issued to cars parked on the street. So please, please, please do not park on the street. It makes it very difficult to plow, and it creates a safety hazard for the cars and everyone around it when there's cars parked on the street. So during a snow event, please do not park on the street. Thank you.
Thank you. Councilmember Smith, I know Trigger's meeting. So I'm assuming you don't have anything to report on tonight.
I don't have anything to report.
Thank you. Councilmember Miller.
Nothing to report.
The only thing that I have on my list is that a resident by the name of Charlie Smith, who lives at the Charleston, he is turning 100 years old. He's a World War II veteran, and the Charleston is having a birthday celebration for him on Saturday from 2 to 4. So you're welcome. Council to stop by if you would like during that time period, 10:22 to 4, to wish him a happy birthday. Councilmember Anderson.
The only thing I have to report, actually, Councilmember Smith could report this too. She and I went together to the elected officials training meeting put on by the ULCT on Saturday. Spent tonight's day over in Taylorsville learning about our elected positions, so that was a good training in the meeting.
Councilmember
Gillis.
Councilmember Ellsworth. Nothing to say. Okay. So we move on to the scheduled items, starting with item number 8, which is a review action on Cedar Hill Subdivision, Platte High Oak Road Parcel. So I'm assuming, Mrs. Connie, you'd like to speak during that time? Okay. Come on up.
Oh, right now?
Yes.
My name is Sherry Conte. I live at 4221 West Oak Road North. I have a little sister, and when we were young, she started borrowing my socks. I complained to her mom, but she didn't really do anything about it because she said it wasn't hurting anybody. But to me, it was a matter of, this is mine, that is yours, leave mine alone. I found I was saying, it's the principle of the matter a lot. It wasn't until I was older that I learned the value of we and ours. Still older, I learned the value of we the people.
Yeah.
I've been called trusting and naive, but I'd rather have the term principled used instead. To me, it's important to be careful about what I say. If I feel the need to change my mind about something, it usually takes some long thinking and, yes, sometimes some hard lessons. I like to think I can count on what people tell me. To me, it's important. I'd like to think I can rely on both my government and your documents assure me. When you prove me wrong, it's a bitter experience that often makes me confront with what I think is a lie that's even harder than before. Because it's the principle of the matter. When the plat by Lot 26 was declared common area, I felt compelled to seek out some legal information. I met with a few professionals from out of the county who understood my frustration, and they were willing and able to get involved as spokespeople for the issue. But when I met recently with a land consultant in Utah County, I learned that things are looked at differently here. Unbelievably, there's no definition of open space. I was told about the history of Cedar Hills, its politics, and human nature. He referred to development here as the Wild West. There's no teeth in the general plan because everything is the politics of here and now. It comes down to influence and how people on a city council vote. City budgets are the hardest. When debt is large and taxes are insufficient to cover parkland, services, and law enforcement, some things have to be abandoned. So I'm trying to understand that what's going on here is the city is doing the best you can. Your citizens are only human, and we all like to have things handed to us for free, especially property. An opportunity has come out of nowhere, so you and the plat owners want to get the best out of it you can. But since holding on to principles keeps me from being cynical, I'm still here asking you to keep the parcel intact and available for future public space. Remember, we, the people of our next generation. I'll end with a quote from Pascal. Nature imitates herself. A seed thrown into good ground brings forth fruit. A principle thrown into a good mind brings forth fruit. Everything is created and conducted by the same master, the root, the branch, the fruits, the principles, the consequences. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Hazelbaker.
My name is Ken Hazelbaker. I live at 10253 North Oak Road West. And going right across the west end of the, I don't even know how you call it anymore. What do we call it, Sherry? Is it open or common or what space? Whatever. That's like green space, okay? We enjoy the neighborhood. We've been there for about 4 or 5 years. And when Ray, and we're really grateful that things have transpired to where now there won't be any buildings built there that is an open spot. But so when Ray and Tyler came around with the plan to be able to incorporate the encroached spaces into their property, I thought that sounded pretty good. And I still like that, Ray. I think that's a good idea. The one concern I have, because I support Sherry in keeping that as an open space, who knows what's going to happen in 10, 15 years? We just don't want to have it take it away if you don't have the options to do something with that space. And I'm really concerned about where the Gobbles property comes down in a tight triangle, creates a gore point with what the Catamol's encroached increased space was, to where there's only, and I don't know, you've probably got it, but probably about 5 feet or something like that existing, okay? I really think, and I don't know how to work it out, but what I would propose is either to ask the Gobbles to go back or ask the Catamol's to go back, or ask the Gobbles if we could just slice off a little bit of their triangle. They're never going to use it. I mean, I talked to Dave. He said, no way in the world I'm going to give up any of that. So I don't know what's going to happen. But we need to maintain enough space there so that there can be a trail, if, you know, there wants to be a trail. I just think the way it currently is, and I don't want to derail what you guys are doing, but I just think we need to make sure that we have 12 to 15 feet for a clear access to that. So if that means putting the cannibal stuff on hold while your guys' stuff goes through, because I agree with what you guys are doing, and I'm sorry it didn't dawn on me when I first looked at the plans.
So I just have to ask you to address us so we can hear you in the microphone.
Oh, I'm sorry. So support the current boundaries for what the Lanes and the Gardeners have proposed. I feel that if the Catamole encroachment is incorporated, we create a currently an unacceptable gore point that destroys any future options for passing through there with a track. It doesn't have to be a great big freeway or anything like that. I don't even think it has to be ADA. I just think about 15 feet would work out pretty good. And just came from you, I was talking to so those are what my concerns are for that.
Thank you. Is there anybody else here that wanted to speak on item 8? Okay. So we will close the public
comment. Excuse me, I don't came to my mind. I want to know, Chandler or whoever, is it possible to approve the Lanes and the Tyler's proposal and maybe deal with the Catamole thing a little bit later?
We'll talk about that during the discussion. Okay. Okay. Mr. Goodwin, come on up.
Given the history of this parcel a number of times, so I'm going to kind of skip over that. But the request tonight is, like was mentioned in public comment, to formalize four separate encroachments that have occurred into this common area over the course of, they're not new encroachments, they're probably decades old cases. And state code does provide a mechanism whereby a common area that is jointly held as like an HOA can be modified. That is kind of important here because it does center on what kind of a common area it is, and that's why we tabled this item in November. This has always been identified as open space on the reported plat from the late 70s when this was approved. But it was held privately, and when the last private owner failed to pay property taxes on this piece, it reverted to a tax sale, like normal property does. But the Utah County Attorney's Office flagged it, saying this is open space, this is common area, and it can't be held privately. So it reverted back to common area, like it's shown now. Whereas if you click on the parcel and look at the history of it, it shows an actual owner in previous years. So my conversation with the county was that I had a number of questions from the November meeting that I wanted to get answered. One was, in their eyes, is there a distinction between open space, common area? And they said no. They treat them all as community areas for their purposes. We throw out these names, but for purposes of the county, they're treated as one. Another issue that was brought up was the taxes on this parcel. The taxes on the parcel are very, very little. I want to say they were $18 to $20 last year. That assessment, that par value assessment, gets spread between every owner on that plat, which, with the county making adjustments to property tax anyways, it would be very hard to differentiate between what's adjustment to your normal property tax versus what's new here. And the last thing was on the petition that was submitted, how do you handle properties that are no longer part of that parcel? Let me explain what I mean by that. The original plat by Cedar Hills it is this right here. And you can see the that there's this open space, lot 26 in the center here. And from the time that this was recorded to now, these three lots here have been platted off onto a separate plat. Four lots that are under consideration tonight are lot 4, lot 5, lot 19 and 20, is that correct? Okay. We'll go over those proposed adjustments right now. We'll talk about state code right now. State code treats this, there's kind of a number of things that have to happen for a common area that's jointly held by an HOA to be modified. This comes from state code 10-98-606, section 5. It says that a person may modify the size or location of or separately convey a common area or common area facility if the following approve the conveyance or modification. A is the local government, that's why this site is before you tonight. B, for a common area that an association is not owner, for a common area and facility, 67% of the owners of lots, units, and parcels designated on a plat that is subject to a declaration and on which the common area or common area facility is included. So they have a petition that shows 67%, at least 67%, I think it's actually closer to 75%, right, of the homeowners in adjacent, on the this recorded plat, it's the property owners, whoever owns property gets a say in this petition.
Excluding 103 now?
Excluding 103, since those, based on my information I got from the county, those have since been amended off onto a separate plat. So yes, if they do meet the threshold for the various modifications, let's look at those lot of modifications. And the choke point that Mr. Hazelbaker referred to is this narrow area between lot 20 and lot 3. It's this one right here. So where I'm going to start, there. So here's the proposal. This is the choke point. So this is the Gardner modification. You can see the shaded area is where the proposed boundary adjustment would happen. The Cattermole modification is this shaded area, and you can see where the original space between these two lots is. It's actually quite narrow right there. And this was the point that I brought up with the city before. Years ago, for a long time, this was in the capital projects plan as a potential park of the city, where it changed ownership to be owned by the neighborhood. We no longer felt that it was appropriate for the city to do anything with it, just like we wouldn't do anything with any other HOA's common area or park area. But one of the problems we had with possibly developing this would be this choke point, which is bigger, is correct. That we had always imagined this as a nature preserve or a trail or just somewhere you can walk through. It's not a park in the sense that I'm going to take my kids there and go to soccer. It just wouldn't work that way. But getting from this section of the open space to this section of the open space with this encroachment is extremely difficult. So Mr. Hazelbaker is correct in that regard. The other two encroachments are both owned by Mr. Lane, those two lots here. This lot here on the corner is undeveloped. And in my conversations with Mr. Lane, he stated that in an effort to prevent this portion of the open space from being developed, he would request that this be added onto this lot so that it doesn't lock it down. So it does not create enough space for a buildable lot here on this portion. Which I understand that because there's been a number of proposals for a home on that portion of the open space. However, now that it's commonly held, it's a little bit different story. So I've spoken with them, and should the council approve this tonight, I've requested that this entire plat be replatted, not just these four lots, not just the four Beckett lots, but the entire plat, and the plat that show where it currently is. Because there's been a dispute of, I'll say, third modification of this plat, I can name off the top of my head. Like I said, these lots, 1, 2, and 3, are no longer part of this plat. Lots 25 right here, and 25 and 7, have been joined in the one lot. This would be the third. So there's not been a number since 1977, there's been a number of changes to this lot, this plat. I think that's all I have to present. Is there any questions for Mayor and Council to answer?
What's the process for the replatting?
They would have to go to a surveyor to take this plat, these survey points, and their new points, and incorporate them. They would get a Mylar printed, and then it would come to the City Council. We have to approve what they submit.
So on that, I know there's no discussion right now about the rest of the property. You haven't had any discussions with anybody else on the rest of the property, what would happen to
it? There's no active documentation on what would happen with the rest of the open space.
But if the one section was approved, in your opinion, there would not be a way to do a trail through that section any longer, or and access
probably
would not exist.
I don't believe so. The problem is Mr. Isbeck is right that the topography here, Elk Grove up here to Oak Court down here, there's a significant elevation change, and that elevation change is found all through here. So this isn't a flat area that even if you have 5 feet wide, you can just lay a sidewalk down easily. It's actually quite difficult. It's quite steep. I mean, there are some nice, more level areas, but there's still plenty. This is more level. This would be, you could do something with this portion against the road, and this actually is quite steep here, but there's some more level portions up here adjacent to the road. But through here, this choke point is quite steep.
But there's a rock wall there.
Right, I was going to say, isn't there an existing...
There's a rock wall that pitches this, yeah, like a pulling area of like.
That one graphic shows, what, two retaining walls?
So that's the thing that looks like it's... Right. So it's this point right here. You can see this retaining wall. It's kind of tough to see with that light there, but that's the property line, that's the retaining wall, so that's the slope. So you'd be building a walkway path on top of the retaining wall.
And you have so you another have retaining wall.
You have some path. You might have to have another retaining wall. You have to have another retaining wall possibly here, as well as a guardrail or some sort.
Even if those encroachments weren't there, they would still be a steep slope, which would make a path not possible.
Right.
So I don't see
when I talk about path, though, I'm speaking from the city's perspective in that when we design our trails, when we design our paths, we're designing it to be ADA compliant. That's what we're going for here. That's why I'm speaking of getting a path that would be ADA compliant could be very good. I don't think it's impossible. I just think it's very cost prohibitive.
Even if the encroachments didn't exist.
Even if the encroachments didn't exist, it's still a challenge. Yeah. But the fact that they do exist, and that you have to, even removing them and putting them in a way, still presents a hillside challenge. That's just the nature of this piece.
So my question is, who would put in a path at this point on private or public property?
Well, when you say privately held, we're talking privately held by everyone on that
path.
So you've got 26 different owners. Call them the board of directors or whatever you want to call them. But it would be up to them. So let me give you an example in that. We have a number of HOAs in the city. I'm just going to use one right behind me. As the example of Cedars. In the center of the Cedars is Hayes Circle, and Hayes Circle is a park. And they have an HOA board where they submit dues, you're a member of this, and they vote on what they want to see done in their park. The city has no say. When they do a building, we give a building plan, but we don't tell them this is what you have to do with your park, this is what you can't do with your park. it's up to them. And this land would be very truly treated just like it's up to this neighborhood. The only challenge is that where there's an established HOA for the Cedars, there is nothing established here. There's not a pool of money being saved somewhere in an escrow account to be spent on weed abatement or maintenance in any way, shape, or form, or development. So it's a unique,
but yet collectively, the group of owners are technically responsible for weed abatement and everything else.
Correct.
Chandler, can I ask you a question?
Sorry, I'll have to do that at the meeting. So in that same vein, these homes that surround this area have collectively decided that they approve these encroachments.
Yeah.
They've signed a petition, they've given their permission to change the property lines, and this is their property, and they've decided that that is what they want to see happen. So...
Yeah. I mean, when we get any sort of application, from the city's perspective, we process that application and we try to do it as best we can in a time sensitive manner. But this is us taking the application. Colleen has verified the signatures, and we actually sent back some saying, hey, you got to fix this one doesn't work, or you've got to get this one. Because we thought like the homeowner should be signatory to it, there being one of the lines of item that parcels being changed. But then we take that and we bring it to the council. And we say, here's what we feel you can do. And we ran it by our attorneys at Kurt McConkey. I spoke very, very briefly about it with our new attorney, Lisa, tonight, Craig Hall. And if there are any objections to anything at this point, I encourage chime in, or if there's anything where we've gone astray. It's really, the state code lays out the process pretty clearly. And so local government, that's your role. So they've done their end. Now it's your role to say, we feel like this is in the best interest of the community, or to say no.
So one other question, could you go back to the encroachments on the pinch area? So, if you are going to require or request from the council that if we approve this tonight subject to a replat, why don't? I mean, it seems to me that we ought to just eliminate a pinch point there and create two separate open spaces so we never have to have this discussion again. I mean, give the generals and the gobbles. Take that line right next to each other and be done with it. Then we never have to have this discussion.
I think the problem with that is that there have been 67% of the people that have signed off on this one, but there's not 67% that would have signed off on the modifications in the ISR.
But, okay, so the replat would be to plat it exactly as is, but we would be create a new plat map.
It would be to take these encroachments, formalize them, and show them as new property lines on a new plat. Shows the entirety of the
platform. Yeah, and I think it's important just to understand again, number one, there is no discussion that has occurred with the city about the city ever taking ownership of any of this land. So right now, I know that there's been some discussion that it was on our capital project plan and such, and that is true, but the information we have now from the county is that that's not something that can be in our capital project plan because it's owned by the plat owners, and we have no say in what they're going to do with it, other than we can say it's got to be open space, but things like the encroachments, we can't make them remove those encroachments. That's a civil issue.
Correct. Right. Let me add to that, Mayor, that we did do a zone change for this piece because it was intended to be a city park at some point. We moved it in 2015, We moved it into public facilities. So, like I said, we have a number of commonly held areas that are held by HOAs in the city. None of them are in the public facility zone. So due to that, I feel like this is now in the wrong zoning designation, and it should be in the residential zone of the underlying zone. So my proposal is that the council direct staff to begin the process of putting this back in the R1 11,000 zone, like all other privately held common areas are. We have it in the townsite residential zone, we have some in the hillside zone, we have some PR2.3 zone. They're all over the city, but they're none of them are part of the public facility zone.
That would apply also to the space next door, right? Is it current?
Yes.
So it's going to be.
Yes. So there's another adjacent lot. And we years ago we talked with owners about purchasing this lot, these lots, when it was privately held by one individual. And the cost was just astronomical for what we needed. So that's where there's just been a real discussion. That's why the city never ever became owners of this land.
So my opinion, I mean, general plans and the capital project plan do not have the force of law. They can and should be changed frequently as the, you know, the makeup of the city changes and things must be changed. And because it was long ago designated to become a part of the city, that's what's supposed to happen. It does not have the force of law. I think that the petitioners have fulfilled their side of their responsibility in getting their signatures, getting this redrawn so that we can see what we're voting on here today. They fulfilled their end of bargaining. And most of the people who live around this open space have approved those changes. My information is to also approve them. Do you want to make a motion? I do. I would like to make a motion to approve the proposed adjustments to the common area open space on Cedar Hill subdivision Cat I, adjacent to lots 19, 4, and 20, according to the Utah State Code 10-9A-606.
I have a motion made by Councilmember Anderson. Is there a second?
I'll second that.
Second by Councilmember Geddes. Is there any further discussion?
Would you like to amend, I mean, just to add that at staff's yes, to
Yeah, I would like to add to the rest of the zoning process and then to re-plot the entire plot. Right, staff reads only process and to get the plot. So is that your amendment? That was my amended motion. So I will second that. Is there any further discussion on this item? Mayor? Sorry, Mr. Hazelmaker, I have a question and it wasn't responded to about could that catapult thing be put on hold for further discussion?
The agenda item before us has been noticed for these plots, and so we can put everything on hold if the council wants to do that, but they cannot modify an agenda item.
Well, I would assume that the same process can be followed to make changes yet again.
For the other plots.
For whatever might be in question.
It seems like it could go one way, though. Once you give them the land, so if I'm understanding right, once you give them the land, you can't go back and say we're going to 67% of it. Well, sign up.
No, not once this.
So you can modify, you can further modify.
You can modify the remainder.
You had it correct. Yes.
So if the council wants to do that, I would recommend that you table the item instead of approving it tonight. To table the item and ask the owners to go back and discuss again.
I don't see yourself.
My opinion in part is that there comes a point where so many things have happened with this, the status, the ownership, the use of the property. At a certain point, you have to consider hitting the reset button. And you have to consider the consequences and what that's going to do and who that's going to affect. But you also have to figure out if that's going to resolve any problems and clear and get some clarity to the owners of the lots around it and the community that co-owns that land. You know, I could be wrong, but it sounds like I don't get the impression that the ownership is going to fund transforming this open space into some type of park, especially with the geographic challenges and and the cost that that entails. I don't see it as realistic or foreseeable. I think that that those who have encroached, there's probably many reasons for that encroachment. It is what it is. There's a number of choices, but the two main choices are to accept this proposal from the majority of the people that, the large majority of people live in the area, or something that results in people removing their encroachments, which is very costly and expensive as well. I support what Council Member Anderson is saying. I think that this is what the people in the community want. Not all of them, obviously, but a lot of them. I think it resolves a lot of issues. It doesn't take away on any individual's specific rights or use of their own property. It only adds to a few and eliminates some of the community space, the open space. That's a long-winded way to say that I support Councilmember's motion.
I agree with that. I mean, it's, the law has been followed. Majority of the people now own the land approved. I find it very hard as somebody who's been elected to represent the people to say, no, they've spoken. I believe we should support that.
All right, I have a motion and a second. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. We will move on to item number 9, which is a review of action on acceptance of the 2019 fiscal year audit.
I am going to turn the time over to Stephen Rowley, who's here with Christensen. He's going to give us our office presentation. So, auditors.
Mayor, members of the council, thank you for having me. My name is Stephen Rowley. I'm an engagement partner on Cedar Hill's financial statement audit for the fiscal year ending June 30th, 2019. And there's a few things that we are required to do as auditors, and at least from the auditor required to report to those under charge of governance, that is you guys. You oversee all the day-to-day operations of the city. You're responsible for the financial reporting of the city. Obviously, you're not doing that yourself, so you hire a great team of people to handle those day-to-day things, with Chandler, Charlotte, and the rest of the finance department, as well as the city treasurer, reporter. All those individuals have important aspects to the financial reporting of the city and ensuring that the funds of the city are properly safeguarded. So as we go through, there's a few things we want to go over. Well, let's jump into the opinion. I believe you all have a copy of the report electronically in front of you. Hopefully you've had a time to read through a little bit. Hopefully you didn't fall asleep too much reading through it. But there is a lot of good information in these reports, and the finance department does an amazing job putting this information together in a way that's helpful to readers to understand what's going on. So the first thing we want to jump to is our audit opinion, and that's going to be found on page 10.
I'm going to pause for just a second. Mr. Goodwin, that is not going to happen.
It's on the website. There's a link in the memo to something on the website. The memo.
You can put it on the screen. Yeah.
I can pull it up on the screen if you'd like.
I don't have a copy of it either.
So I'll just pull that up. Just go over a few other things so we don't waste any time. Let's see. So even though you have this great finance department and people doing these things, that doesn't relieve you of your responsibility to ensure that the controls are in place and that things are being reported properly. So as part of your responsibilities, you oversee the controls of the city. And one of the things we wanted to point out as well is during this fiscal year, the city did they did some improvements on their cash receiving processes and controls to beef those up just a little more. They were sufficient beforehand, but they identified ways that they could improve their safeguard of the city's assets for the money that they're collecting. And I feel like that was a very positive move that helps ensure more accurate reporting and more proper safety of those funds to reduce any kind of risk of loss and theft or anything like that. Our responsibility as auditors is to finally perform the audit in accordance with auditing standards. So we look over the internal controls of the city and determine what's the extent of the testing that we need to do in order to give our opinion on these financial statements. So what you have up here on page 10, if you've had a chance to download it yourself, the wording is a little hard to read because it's pretty small. The bottom of that is a paragraph that has our opinion on it. So in our opinion, the basic financial statements referred to above present fairly in all material respects the respective financial position of the governmental activities, business type activities, each major fund, and the aggregate remaining fund information of the City of Cedar Hills Econ as of June 30th, 2019, and the respective changes in financial position and where applicable cash flows thereof, and the respective budgetary comparison for the general fund and the all special revenue fund for the year ended in accordance with accounting principles generally accepted in the United States of America. That's a lot to say that it is an unmodified opinion, a clean opinion for all intents and purposes there. So the financial statements reported here at June 30, 2019 are materially correct. I've gone through and tested those and are confident in our ability to give that opinion on the financial statements. Additionally, in this report, it discusses what's called required supplementary information. And what's included there is the pension schedules that show the city's proportionate share of the entire retirement system liability. There's a schedule that's been built out to 10 years there that helps give you an idea of how that can change from year to year. There's also budget actual schedules that are there. And in terms of our opinion on those, that is given as a whole. We do not individually test those items, nor are we required to. But they do reconcile back to that underlying accounting information, which has been audited and is shown there in the report for your information. And that's located after the notes of the financials. It's more towards the end of the report. The last paragraph of that report says that there's another report on government auditing standards that go ahead and jump to. That's going to be page 115, so PDF data 21.5. So all audits within the state of Utah are required to be done under government auditing standards, which there's generally accepted auditing standards, and then government auditing standards bump those requirements up a little higher. So what this report, so it's a couple pages. So what this is, there's two parts to this report. There's an internal control over financial reporting that we look at. As I mentioned earlier, we do look at the internal controls of the city. Those would be the things that are part of the processes or procedures to ensure that the money coming into the city and the money going out and how the financials are prepared, are those being done properly so that you have accurate financial information to make decisions from. So we look at those internal controls and determine how much testing we're going to do. However, as part of that, we do not test those controls to give an opinion on those controls specifically. However, as part of our looking over those internal controls, we did not identify any deficiencies or weaknesses in those internal controls. So all in all, there's a pretty strong internal control system within the city. And the second section that starts at the bottom of that page is the compliance and other matters. Government auditing standards also requires that we look at compliance-related issues that could have a material impact on the financial statements. So we look over certain areas of compliance to see if there's something there that if the city did not comply with that, it would have a material impact on the financials, if they misstate things or bring up errors within the numbers that are reported. And we did not identify any issues in compliance to be reported here. So there's no opinion related to that. Just, we didn't identify any weaknesses or deficiencies in internal controls, and we didn't notice any non-compliance with those compliance requirements that would have a material effect on the financials. Next page, next report, just a couple pages in. This is the report required by state compliance. an audit guide to the state auditor, puts out every year an audit guide that states every governmental entity within the state is required to be tested over certain areas. So about a third of the way down the page was that indented list of items that has areas such as budgetary compliance, fund balance, retired retirement systems, etc. So this compliance bag states that you're required to look at, similar to the previous report, the internal controls over compliance over these areas, as well as specific instances of compliance over these areas. So we follow that compliance guide to determine the testing that we do. We look at these specific areas. Similar to the previous report, we did not identify any deficiencies or weaknesses in controls over compliance with these state compliance requirements. And additionally, we did not find any instances of non-compliance as we went through these testings. In this report, there is an opinion on compliance at the very bottom of that page. It states, in our opinion, the City of Cedar Hills complied in all material respects for these state compliance requirements referred to above for the year ended June 30th, 2019. So that's a great job. It's fairly rare to see a city that does not have any state compliance findings. They're fairly common. So great job. That's not just the finance department that does that either. There are a lot of people within the city that can impact these compliance requirements. So that's a great job. Just for your information, I recommend reading through the management's discussion and analysis that starts on page 12. That puts things in a more easy to read way to approach the finances of the city. It gives a bigger overview, kind of a bird's eye view of what happened in the city from last year to this year, and some explanation on some significant areas. Some of the significant things that happened during the year for information as well. There was a new standard that was implemented, GASB 88, and all that really did was help increase the transparency on how debt was procured by the city, whether it was directly placed with an entity or if it was kind of a public placement of debt. That didn't change anything how the numbers were reported, just in the footnotes it would clarify the data of that information. That was the only new standard that was required for this fiscal year. There was also some additional liability that was reported as a result of Cedar Hills voting to leave Longview Public Safety District. And as of the end of the year, the estimate that was there ended up being a little less than city staff had actually anticipated, so that's positive. From my understanding, that number still has not been finalized. So as that is an estimate, obviously that still could change somewhat. And there were some significant construction projects that were undertaken, and the new driving range bench that was put up, as well as the Harvey Park grading improvements. And during the audit, we did have the opportunity to go out and look at how the progress of that park is going. Personally, I think it looks pretty cool. I'm sure we can see your else.
You can have
someday. Thank you. Someday I'll be able to see you. But we did have no difficulties in performing the audit. The staff were very great at giving us information in a timely manner. The plan was to still have this ready by the November meeting, but I think there was some plans to discuss other items, so that was pushed on until this council meeting. So, had a great time with the audit. All the staff were very professional and giving us information very timely. So, we appreciate the opportunity both for Charlotte and the rest of the city staff. And that is my report. Is there any questions you may have on how the audit went?
I do want to thank you for your flexibility. I know I think we moved the meeting once or twice, so thank you for your willingness to do that. I personally don't have any questions. I do want to thank Charles and everyone else in the city staff. I know it's a lot of work, and thank you for all your efforts and for you keeps us on the right track. Any questions from the council?
Staff obviously is doing an amazing job. Ditto for you. I mean, that's the entire city, actually, I think. It's not just the finance department. I'll take credit and job. You know, I think every department has a role. And like you said, there's things they have to do right for to make sure it's successful. Thank you.
I will take a motion.
I'll make a motion to accept the 2019 annual financial report.
Motion made by Councilor Ellsworth. Was that a second? Seconded by Councilmember Anderson. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion passes unanimously. Thank you.
Thanks, Sam.
We will move on to item number 10, which is review action on appointment of Leo Pro Tem.
here. First, let me echo what Stephen said. We do have a wonderful staff. It really is. I know Charlotte and his team do a lot of work on the audit. This is a time-consuming effort. So for Charlotte's, finish the audit and check into the budget. So I think that's it's kind of time to appoint a new mayor pro tem. Councilmember Anderson has done a wonderful job. But as with our tradition, we rotate that. So there is a proposal to make Councilmember Ellsworth the new mayor pro tem for the calendar year. Any questions?
Not sure I can deal with it down there as well.
So he needs to make sure you do it.
Yeah. He's done a great job. Well, I said we've invested.
Yeah. All right, I'll take a motion.
All right. I'll move that we appoint Council Member Ellsworth as the mayor pro tem for the calendar year 2020.
And I'll second.
Motion made and seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion is unanimous. We'll move on to item number 11, review action on resolution making assignments to members of city council staff and residents on certain boards, committees, and entities. And I actually do want to start off on this one just saying I heard back from a couple of council members, but not everyone. And so if there are changes we need to make tonight, we can do so.
Because we talked about being on Family Festival, but did Brian ask? Brian?
No. So I heard, so yes, but I have you on Utah Lake Commission and then also on. Yeah, you have all these back.
Yeah.
So, everybody else. But if we need to switch it around, we can, because I didn't get a chance to talk to Councilor or Miller. So if there are things we need to switch around, now's an opportunity to do so.
I just want to say, I'm fine. I would rotate finance every once in a while, but it's
okay. And we do have a rotating council member there. Usually just have to open that to whoever either that time. So Councilmember Smith will be the assignment, the appointed one to the committee. But we do need, does Utah Lake have a special level of ultimate?
Campo.
Okay. But Utah Lake Commission does allow us to. So is there somebody who would like to be the alternate to that? They meet once a quarter. Right now they're meeting 7:30 to 9:30, but they may change it. Because they're having opportunity in the forum at that time.
Is that morning or night?
7:30 a.m. to 9:30 a.m. That's a quarter. That's why they're having a hard time getting the forum.
I didn't know that there was a 7:30 a.m.
Where's the meeting? It's in Provo.
I can do it.
Okay. So we will put Councilman Miller as the alternate there.
It's across the street from my work. So.
Yes. I don't think any other ones can have an alternate. And then on the Legislative Policy Committee, I didn't email you on this, but you have three seats. Traditionally, it's been Chandler and I, and Mr. Paul is going to be appointed as our third seat on the Legislative Policy Committee. Any other, and you see that we have some staff members that are doing some of our city assignments as well. So any changes that we need to make, is everybody comfortable with this? Are you good with that?
That's good.
Yeah, I would say I enjoyed my time on the Sunday Beautification Recreation Parks and Trails. Family Festival is one of my favorite things.
All right. Councilor Ellsworth, you're good with that very long meeting?
So, I'm good.
Okay. All right. If there are no changes other than that one, which is to add Councilor Miller as an alternate to the Utah Lake Commission, and then it. We just put a rotating so that way the last council member gets in the hand, and we're like, it's not an assignment where we have to make somebody.
Right.
Well, I'll make a resolution. All right, make a motion.
So I make a motion to approve resolution number 1-7-2020-A, a resolution assigning members of the city council, staff, and residents of the city of Cedar Hills, Utah, to certain boards, committees, and entities, adding council member Ryan Miller as an alternate to the Utah Lake Commission.
Motion made by council member Anderson. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by council member Ellsworth.
Aye.
Council member Geddes.
Aye.
Anderson.
Aye.
Council member Miller.
Aye.
Council member Smith.
Aye.
Motion passes unanimously. Moving on to item number 12, and we actually need to table.
Oh, sorry, yeah.
We need to table this item because it needs to be done as a resolution since it's an interlocal agreement. So if somebody would make the motion to table that 2018.
I'll make the motion to table item 12.
Motion made by council member Ellsworth. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by council member Miller. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Council, if somebody will make a motion, I'd like to flip 14 and 13.
Make a motion that we flip items number 13 and 14 and discuss item number 14 before 13.
Motion made by Councilor Anderson. Is there a second?
Second.
Seconded by Councilor Geddes. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Let's move on to item number 14 then, and we do have some public comment there, starting with David White. I'll just start with your name and address.
David White, 4198 West Sandalwood Drive. I have been a resident of Cedar Hills for 12 years now. Haven't been very active in coming to these meetings. There's something that triggered me tonight as I saw something that's forwarded to me on the agenda as it pertains to item number 14 in concerning the fencing along the Hopwood in lieu of the driving range fence. I've been here a long time. I've frequently seen problems with the driving range and the balls going over the nets. They've never been high enough. I remained silent on it. I just dealt with it and just figured it was a thing we really couldn't deal with. But when the poles came down, I thought that the city was going to take action and do the right thing and get it right this time and raise those nets. I'm really disappointed at how that was handled. I think it was inappropriately spent, that money. Now we're looking to fix that problem and throw more money at it and create fencing that really doesn't address the issue. The issue is that golf balls are hitting vehicles, including mine, that I'm upset about, but I had no recourse on it. I hit my windshield and it went down Conwood Drive. And it scared me because I thought, what if somebody was either running or coming up the trail in a vehicle? That wall was coming down hot. It was coming down fast. And now there's homes as you go down that corner on Conwood. So I think we have a major issue with this. I'm upset that we mishandled and misrepresented the funds in this. I feel like I oversee procurement in my company. And so I think that more due diligence should have been done. I hope that we won't make two mistakes and keep throwing band-aids at this. Let's rectify the problem and extend the nets. That really takes the problem away instead of just trying to put, fencing and trying to just protect pedestrians. It's not just about protecting pedestrians. It's about protecting property, assets, including vehicles coming up and down. So I'm upset about this, and I'm going to be active from now on. I've spoken with several people that I know. There's a lot of upset individuals, and I'm going to promote that they get out here and be heard on this issue. Thank you, Mayor.
Jason Hart.
My name is Jason Har. I live at 10483 North Way, just across from the Lewis Department. So I too have read the staff recommendation in today's agenda item regarding the fencing along Cottonwood Drive. I wanted to comment on this recommendation idea and give my overall general thoughts again regarding the issue of errant golf balls. The proposed fencing may protect those who are walking on portions of the city trail, but it still does not solve the problem. Why? Because One, the fencing will not protect those who cross the intersection of Mesquite Boulevard. A good portion of the balls could clear the nets, landing the intersection of Mesquite and Cottonwood Drive. Pedestrians have to cross Mesquite to continue. There is still a risk of these people getting hit when crossing the road. People have been narrowly missed in this area. Two, it will not protect people at the park, as mentioned by Jeff Bosbrath. This park is heavily used in the summer, and especially on Saturday, which I'm assuming is the busiest day of the week for the driving range. Three, it will not protect vehicles driving on Cottonwood or Mesquite. Cottonwood is a major road in our small city. Vehicles have been hit. Les Nielsen, who spoke earlier, and myself in 1 year collected over 2,000 golf balls. I separated these balls into balls that had asphalt road scuff marks and those that didn't have road marks. Over half of the balls had asphalt road scuff marks, meaning they hit the road and not the trail. These balls were given back to the city. Four, there's a chance the fencing might actually make things worse by blocking incoming balls and having them bounce back into Cottonwood Drive into oncoming traffic. Five, it's my opinion the fencing would be an eyesore. It would be ugly, and again, it's on a main road in Cedar Hills. I proposed years ago to raise the middle portion of the nets, thus having a gradual raised pole effect. It was discussed that that idea would not be aesthetically pleasing, and that idea was rejected. This fencing would not be aesthetically pleasing either. Six, this is more of a comment slash question. According to the agenda, this idea would cost more than what was proposed last spring in raising the middle sections of the poles. Raising the middle poles, as I understand it, was $24,000 and was rejected. The proposed fencing recommendation will not solve the problem. It will be a waste of money and time. The problem, as I have brought up many times, is that the nets are not installed to an adequate height to protect the public. The poles were once 30 feet tall, they are now 50 feet. In my limited quick research, they should be at a minimum of 80 feet or more high. The ranches, shown here in Eagle Mountain, which appears to be an inferior golf course, has 80-foot poles. The Riverwoods in Provo are at 100 feet. And another course I have passed many times in Santa Fe are 80 feet tall. Note that the poles in the courses mentioned were extended higher or have capabilities of being extended. Our netting is only 50 feet after being raised. They are 40% lower and in some cases have the height as half the height as other range nets. 50 feet is inadequate, especially for a range.
Mr. Harper, I just need you to wrap up.
Sure. That is so close to a major city road, city trail, and public park, and given how narrow and short the driving range actually is, it is not our fault that the driving range was poorly designed. Last comment, real quick. The solution is simple. Raise the nets to an adequate height. Let's quit wasting money and time on this. If this were a privately owned course and the city knew of the same issue or something similar with another company, the city would demand the company in question to remedy the problem. We as a city need to do the same of ourselves. Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me start by addressing something that was brought up in the public comment portion of the meeting. But I have pulled up here, but it's gone. So, Greg sent me the actual final design of the approved NEM. There were some questions as to whether that was actually 50. I can assure you that it is 50 feet. I've done a number of things to verify that in a roundabout way. You can look on Utah County parcel maps and you can see that from that map you can do a measurement and see that the poles are about 45 feet apart. I walked it today, they are about 45 feet apart. And they are taller than they are wide. So, we know that they're 50 feet. You can see from this drawing here that the netting is done in two separate sections where you have
this little line representing the division between the two sections. Each one of those sections netting is 25 feet tall. The fences are 50 feet. Fences they were replacing are 50 feet. Now, yeah, I wish that we could raise these nets, but I'm going to explain why I think that's challenging. I don't think it's impossible, I just think it's very challenging at this time. So, we raised the nets initially, was 2014, 2015, based on some of the feedback we're getting from some of the neighbors, and we really raised only the, this is an area with the driving range, but we really only raised the nets on this portion right here, first few nets. And we found that, yeah, that going from the 30 or 35 feet to 50 feet for just this portion wasn't adequate, and we raised the entirety of the net to 50 feet based on some of the complaints that we received from the neighbors. And they public comment. When those nets were raised, we didn't have complaints. We used to get a lot of complaints from the United Stars soccer group that practices soccer here at the north end of this city soccer park. And when we raised the nets, we stopped getting complaints from them. Greg and Rob, please chime in. Greg was the one who filled those comments or those complaints. So we, when we raised the nets, we raised to 50 feet, we felt like the problem was adequate. So last year in February, we called that the net blew down during the wintertime. So we, based on our understanding of the nets we had were adequate, we replaced them with 50 foot steel poles, being that we didn't want to replace the nets because it blew down. This is the second time that the poles had been compromised in some manner. So we felt that we had solved the problem. However, and if you recall, I told the council that these nets are not going to catch every ball. We know that that's not the case. They're not going to catch every ball. Based on how many balls were turned in by Mr. Hart and how many buckets of balls get hit, I would estimate that probably somewhere in the 2% of balls leave the net or leave the range, which over time can be number of balls. It's the worst. So the mayor and I went and met with Mr. Olson and Mr. Carr a few months ago. But the concerns that were raised were really on safety. And when you're on a golf ball, we're on a golf course, if I'm golfing here on this fairway and a golfer hits a ball and hits me, yeah, that golfer's liable for their shot, but I assume some risk when I'm golfing. I assume that risk by being on the course. We didn't feel that the people that were using the trail here were assuming that same risk. And so safety became the paramount concern here. And it really supersedes aesthetics, and it was the safety of specifically pedestrians, children walking along that trail, cyclists, anybody going up and down that trail that did not have the protection of the car. So we tried to find some solution, and Greg's staff came up with the idea, and that's why it's just a discussion item tonight. It's not, we're not voting on anything right now. Why don't we do the same thing that we've done on hole number one, which is put in fencing that shields and creates a safe pathway. Let me show some pictures of those, that fencing. This is that fencing looking north on the trail. So we're actually teeing off up on the hillside up here. We're teeing up over this fence. And there is actually a gap in this fence too, as carts have to go from up top and they drive through onto the course. So there actually is a gap on this one, similar to what we're proposing to be in this park. But let me show you one more picture in that you can see where the light hits this fence, you can see all the balls that have hit this fence. It does work for creating a safe mode of transportation getting through that part of that trail system. And it's heavily used, and to my knowledge, we've never had an incident of anyone getting hit by a ball or hole or one, right?
Never.
Never. So that's why we thought this was, if safety of pedestrians in the area is the primary concern, this is a way to address safety. The proposal is a cost-effective way of addressing that safety concern. We've talked about raising the nets, and we reconfirmed with the company today that the nets, the poles that we have there in place right now, by building code, can only be raised with an extension net another 10 feet. So if we were going to raise those nets to 80 feet, they would have to be a complete replacement rebuild of probably 5 to 7 sections of poles. The cost to raise just 5 to 7 sections based on the bid we got today was $106,000, something like that.
To raise it to what?
To raise 5 to 6 sections of net 10 feet was $100,000. It was expensive. Based on that,
to raise it to 60 feet per section?
Yeah.
Chandler, can I add to that?
Please do.
It also adds 2 additional sections at the end that were reduced.
Okay. So that's where the difference is in what the $24,000 was that you were mentioning, Mr. Carr, because it doesn't lengthen that net to the full length. The nets that we have now, they don't go as far as they used to. There's a gap here where the nets used to be and they're not. So that's something that staff has looked at when we're trying to shore up. The reason that is if I zoom in on this, where the plan called for 45 feet between each net, one of those poles is going to be sitting on the sewer main line, and that's not ideal. It's the trunk line for the whole subdivision behind us. So if there were ever a problem with that trunk line or that pole, too much pressure on that main line, it could burst. Maybe we have some serious problems in our driving range would be assessed for. So that's why we had to position these fences, these poles, in this area, not at 45 feet, but to keep the poles off from being directly above that main line. But what that did was it shortened it on this other end over here. And there are a number of balls that we see that escape around this as they have a long low hook, or sorry, long low slice. They'll just curve around the rest of this net. So we've looked at adding another pole extension in a way kind of diagonally comes off of that and putting that in. But the big concern right now was the users of this trail system right here. So we felt that by adding a covered fence that goes up 6 feet and then angles over to give some protection to the golf balls coming down from about this point to the corner and then picks up again for a bit of space here, about 100 feet, would give that protection. That was the proposal the staff came up with that costs about $25,000 versus the $100,000. We could raise these nets 10 more feet, but balls are still going to get over.
So, can I ask a question? And maybe this is directed to Graham. If we had any instances of a pedestrian being seriously hurt by a golf ball from a golf range, driving range?
Not that aware.
Okay.
Do you have data on how many cars are reported being hit?
That's not something we've tracked, but we can go through and probably look through emails and find that out. I'm happy to just start looking at that. I can think of a couple instances where cars got hit, but cars don't just get hit along the top, they get hit along Canyon Road too. I've seen instances where a car got hit on Canyon Road and broke the windshield. So the problem with cars is just along the top of this portion of the course.
Can you also discuss that? You and I, and we talked to Greg and Wade a few times too, some of the other things that we
have. I feel like I can compress that right now.
That's great.
I mean, maybe not real fast. We kind of caught them at a time when the course was winding down where they weren't being used as much as I probably needed, Mr. Carter. But some of the things we talked about were Because like I said, the golf balls that we've got hit over, we're looking at trying to minimize that 2 to 3% of balls that are going over the fence, which, you know, is probably like 7 to 10 balls a day. How do we reduce that number? We talked about a couple of ways where it's hard to see here, but typically we drive teeing straight off perpendicular to the fence. And one of the ways we talked about was, what if we angled that just ever so slightly so that rather than balls going straight out of the driving range, what if they went out this way? So would turn and maybe land more so than the driving range. Because when we hit a tee box, most golfers will hit straight between those two tee markers, and they'll hit straight out from a perpendicular to where they're going, even though that's not necessarily where the hole is. Sometimes they just line up that way, especially on a driving range course. We've also talked with waiting staff about allowing for drivers in some areas and only irons in other areas to try to minimize that falls going over as well. And I believe he had signs made, I believe USO was in his office.
I think so.
Yeah. So we talked about that. We also have the limited range white balls that don't go as far as normal golf balls, so we've tried to minimize the risk there as well.
We have those now.
Well, we've had those for a while, but that's not something new. And we're open to, we've even gone so far as to what if we shifted the way we hit the driving range. A lot of these solutions, using the term loosely, are more cost prohibitive than raising the nets. So looking at ways to try to chip into the number of golf balls being hit over the fence with at the same time being budget conscientious. We've had that conversation with the staff, and while we're beginning to implement some of them, it's where it's off season. Obviously not as big thing right now. But I did task Greg with discussing this with his staff, and they came up with the proposal of this fence for the trail system there. These columns sit high up on the hillside here. A fence is not something that we've seen outside of looking out of view. So I get that it's not a pretty fence, but it does do a job. I would like people, if their cars are hit by the golf balls, I would like them to report it to the city. I would like to know that is happening. I've heard of a number of instances where cars have been hit and people just shake their fist and keep driving. I want to know. I really want to know. Because I can't get an accurate number of how bad the problem is if I'm not told about it. But one other item we talked about is raising the golf green fee $1 per round and taking that dollar and putting it in an escrow account or an account where it just sits, and at the end of the year or during the year when these instances come up where the windshield is broken and we can't find the driver, we work with the vehicle owner to replace that windshield and replace the window. Because the number of windows that are hit and broken are much less than raising the nets another 30 feet, especially. My guess, and I'll get bids on this, but my guess is that if you were to raise 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 sections, 7, 8 sections of fencing and other, replacing those poles and putting in new poles that go up 80 to 90 feet, I believe you're looking at least $250,000 to $300,000.
Anything else from your presentation?
No. So, sorry, I covered everything. Well, did I cover all the items that were brought up? The proposal that we're making right now does not protect vehicles. But from a safety standpoint, my primary concern would be people in all of the trail system here. I have walked the park looking for golf balls on a number of occasions. You typically find them right here in this section, right inside the corner of the park. Once again, adding some sort of backstop there would shield that park too. Still at a cost much less than anything that you find raising the nets for you.
Thank you. So, Council, before we open it up for discussion, just to reiterate what Mr. Newman said, we went and met with Mr. Haar and his neighbor and discussed some of these options. And I appreciate that Mr. Haar has given us some suggestions as well on changing the location of where. I am not a golfer, so I'm going to use all of my terminology. I'm just going to apologize for that up front. But from where they tee off, and I know that Wade has implemented some of those or is looking to implement some of those and specifying drivers and irons, et cetera. So at this point, what we're looking for is Chapman, this is not an action item. We're not voting on anything tonight. It was to bring to the council as another item to discuss, and we're seeking direction from the council on how you want us to proceed. We could look at raising the fences completely. We can look at doing those few sections. We can do this fence. We can not have a driving range anymore, but there's a financial cost to everything that we decide that we want to do, but there's also the safety issues that we're trying to address as well. So staff's looking for directions from the council on what we want to do this time.
My first inclination is to change the orientation of the driving range. I mean, I feel like if you're teeing off in a different direction, it's going to mitigate a lot of the problem. But what's involved in doing that?
Did you have a cost on it? I thought you had an estimate on what you thought that would be.
Greg, can you get an estimate on that? I don't know if you get.
Which one I get? I'm sorry.
View or an intimidating driving range.
Yeah, we talked about it. It's really hard. You're going to have to do a lot of
bulldozes
and stuff.
I mean, it depends on the scale of the reorientation because let's say that you were going to flip it and say, let's have the tee off from this other end. Yeah, but we still have to build the tee boxes on that other end, which involves earthwork, which is never cheap. And you have to also get a cart path out there, which is also.
I think the no cost solution is to just, they put down, I'm a golfer, I got a lot at some time.
Yeah,
so they put down strings. So you stand between the strings, and they're always perpendicular, you tend to go straight out. If you put the string on an angle and just put down any grade or anything else, I think there's a lot of things we could do here without spending any money.
That's what we've tried to do, so you can kind of see the string right here, it's banking, it's there. But taking that angle, you can see the way that it's angled in relation to the legs, in relation to driving speeds. Fairly perpendicular, so you're hitting straight out from the right range. So yeah,
it seems like it looks a little odd initially, but I think the point is that when you do set up, if you got used to it being at a slight angle, you would make left. And I would attest that I'm the only golfer on the other than right.
Well,
Kelly's a golfer.
Right.
Yeah. My husband is a golfer.
On a rare occasion, I have. But and then moving any flags. For things that people
we talked about purchasing targets, they're pretty cheap.
Yeah, put them on that far left side.
In this direction, some balls being in this direction rather than this direction.
I mean, I have a terrible slice, and so I'm usually like facing like 30 degrees left just to try and compensate. But
the other thing that we have discussed, if I can add, is the tee boxes that channeling at the front there, they're actually elevated. And we've talked about, bringing in a bulldozer and dropping that down. It's a lot of work, it's a lot of money, but it could drop instead of doing 80 feet fence, you drop that 20, 30 feet. That might help. That's a lot of money to do that too.
If looking at this map, that sand trap right there is actually just a big pile of weeds. It's not a sand trap. Maybe look at moving the city out more. Yeah. Every time I've been there, it's just overgrown.
Where are you talking about?
It is a sand trap. There is sand in it, but it's relatively new.
We're actually filling it in.
Let me touch on one more thing. I'm sorry, there's one thing I forgot to mention. If you recall in our October meeting, we talked about the challenges with budget. One of the issues that we're seeing with budget, looking at your trends, is that our revenues are very flat. We don't have new revenues coming in. Our expenditures are increasing with inflation. And so we try to budget very, very conservatively, and you'll be able to see that at the end of the months coming up to show you our budget projections for FY21. But what that means is that every year we budget conservatively on the revenues, and we usually get more revenues than we're budgeting. And we are able to take that extra revenue, and we're able to take the difference between what is the budgeted expense and what was not expended, and we're able to take that money, and we're able to put it into an unrestricted fund where we can do projects like an emergency year, raise the nets, or rebuild the nets. But what we're seeing, though, is that the amount of that transfer that's going in year over year is shrinking. It's becoming tighter and tighter. So when we have a proposal to raise nets, I'd love 85 nets. I really would. I'd love 94 nets. But at $300,000, I have to look at our unrestricted fund balance and say, what is the greatest need of the city? And so it really comes down to, we have a lot of infrastructure in the city that I don't think is really, when we talk about what the city owns or what the city maintains, I don't think it really comes to the mind very rarely. So we have a mass water system that needs to be updated. And that's by funding the water sewer fund. But we also have buildings. We have this building that's now approaching 10 years old. We have a building with the fire department's in that is 20 years old. We have our building that we work out of that's 15 years old. Well, when buildings start hitting 15, 20 years old, you start having to rebuild. You have to start having to, not rebuild, but to renovate. You have to start talking about fixing the roof. Our public safety building down there, the roof might as well be made of Swiss cheese with as many leaks that we've had in that building. The AC unit, the heaters went out this year. So we're looking at each of those instances, we're looking at another $20,000, we're looking at another $35,000. So we're looking at the critical infrastructure of the city that we have to be keeping up, saying what is the greatest need of the city. And that's why I would love to raise the nets, but at this time, I can't in good faith come to the council say, let's spend $300,000 to do this, knowing that there are other projects that need to be done. That's why this fence is, to me, it's at the minimum, it's a short-term solution that provides a safe route up and down that trail. In the long run, there could be a day when we look at raising the nets to higher height, but in the short run, safety to me trumps some of these other concerns. So that's why I really appreciate Greg's staff for taking the time to brainstorm and come up with this idea of why don't we do this fence. So, that's why we wanted to bring to the council and have this discussion. It's not necessarily, and we want to be very clear with the residents, we really want them to just wake up one morning and there's a fence down there saying, how did this come about? We wanted to be very open with the residents and saying, look, we're thinking about this fence along Conklin Drive because of the concern of the driving range fence. I know that it doesn't alleviate every concern. I am well aware of that. But given some of the budget constraints, I don't feel like at this time that we can alleviate every concern that we have. So
I would just add to that as well. I know there a comment was made earlier about the times that we have changed it and the money that we have spent on it. And I think frustration goes both ways. We're frustrated as well. But I will say every time that we have modified that driving range fence, I know from sitting at this table that everyone who talked about it and who voted on it, it was always with the desire to try to resolve these issues that were coming to our attention. There was never a desire to ignore it, right, to just do the bare minimum. There was a genuine desire to address the concerns that were being brought to our attention in the best way that we could.
I definitely agree with that. We had plenty of discussions on this. I think the next step in my mind, I don't know if it's this fence on the trail or if it's reorienting the T-box. I'd like to see how much that would cost before we make any sort of decision on the fence on the trail. Because I think both would solve the safety issue along with pedestrians. Reorienting the T boxes will also help with the car safety. So, and then, you know, maybe dig it lower. I mean, we don't necessarily have to raise fences, we could go deeper. But it's all it costs. We need to see what this costs to make sure we're doing the right thing for, you know, wisely with the money the city has.
No, I agree.
So if I understand correctly, you would like to get some financial information on reorienting it, meaning you were thinking of adjusting it north,
adjusting
north, and where it's going, and then possibly lowering it.
Yeah, yeah.
I agree.
Yeah, then three different things there. I want to see the price for each of those, so we can see how we can at least move this one. We don't have to call for
it. We'll continue to work on that.
That's what I'm interested in as well. I appreciate the staff brainstorming, coming up with a solution for fences, an interesting proposal, and I think it addresses part of the problem. I would hope that we can find a solution that addresses all of the problem for the cars, for the pedestrians, people in the park, for the homeowners nearby. And if what Councilmember Ellsworth is suggesting, I think if we look into that, and if there's some things that we can do, and maybe it costs $50,000 or $100,000, but it's still less than $300,000. But it's more than the fence, but it addresses more of the problem, if not all of the problem. I think we keep putting our efforts into brainstorming and researching those adjustments, if they'd be effective, what the cost is, and because the next time we spend money on this problem, and if there is a problem, hopefully we can be smart enough and sure enough that it will resolve the problem, and that we're not going to be back here again.
I would add one thing though. I mean, we're all in favor of doing that. We will change the orientation where they tee off, but remember, people are people. They're going to do what they want. And we don't have the personnel to be down there and so far away from the clubhouse. So just understand that we will do that. That's going to be easy. And that's nothing. That doesn't cost us a dime. But we're not there to be able to babysit that and know what's going to happen also. We've seen LDS missionaries down there purposely getting in the houses in the past. So things happen. And unfortunately, we wish people wouldn't do that, but they do it.
Didn't you also put some cameras there? We talked about that one.
Yes.
They are there now.
Yes.
I'm just circling the items that you want us to follow up on. So, in addition to angling, dropping elevation, reorienting, thoughts on the additional fee to and the targets.
We'll run through a number of calls and things that counts as pretty much broken.
The targets just provide a slight incentive for people to change behavior. So people like seeing targets.
What a clown.
Any other thoughts or suggestions that the council wants staff to research so we can come back on this and answer all your questions?
I would just add that if there's ideas from the neighborhood, I'm more than welcome to hear about
it. Chandler, I know that you, based on the information you have from our past expenses and some of the bids that you've received for raising it, and you've guesstimated what it would cost to raise to 80 feet, would you be able to get an actual bid?
Yeah.
And just, you know, whether it's 250 or 500,
yeah,
so
we'll find out some exact numbers for you.
How many poles?
We'll sit down and talk. I think we just need to sit down and identify. I'm happy to run that by you,
please,
Mr. Hart, and say,
let's do some research.
Let's look at which seven poles are you thinking of, because I don't want to just take seven out of the air and just get seven when it's really nine or only five.
I agree.
I'd rather get the right number. I'm happy to sit down and go over those numbers. And it'll take some time getting all the bids, but yeah, I'm happy to work with staff and getting bids without ever going to everybody else.
Yeah, thank you.
Chandler, Greg, can you tell me, you mentioned like people might suggest we just get rid of the driving range. Do we know offhand like what the revenue is for the driving range?
It's not necessarily revenue at the driving range. You're going to lose a lot of golf tournaments, which we've increased tremendously, because if you don't have driving range, they're not going to come to the tournament.
Right.
It's only $100.
Oh, yeah, we talked about having the driving range only open for tournaments possibly.
I mean, you see our budgets, you see how much we do on
the problem that I just said you do is we budget $20,000 to $25,000 a year for the driving range revenues.
But what if we just did that till we saved up for the right then? Just did it for tournaments. I think we could save up for it.
We can throw that out as a puzzle, but it's still some of these ways.
Throw everything out.
I honestly don't love that scenario because I think that what that does is you're then having to increase the subsidy on the golf course.
I think the nice thing about just knowing that what the options are, then it's an easy way to say to residents, this isn't really a fiscal option. Because we're going to lose tournaments or whatever, but if we don't explore it, then we'll still get people saying, well, I'm going to just get rid of the driving range.
I mean, maybe rather than proposing a driving range at all, maybe it's, you know, there's soccer games going on, so we're not going to have a driving range over this. I mean, there's a whole spectrum of ideas that you can explore.
Yeah.
Okay.
And then we need to look at the financial implications as well.
Yes, and I think that's really the underlying key is when you make a decision like this, you have to know what that's going to do for the budget.
And realize that when the new park does open, all of our programs are on that park anyway, so it'll reduce the people at that park.
Will the soccer league not be using the ski park anymore?
Yeah, but we can push them to the south side at that point very easily.
I just want to point out, Mr. Golfer, that the net where it currently is about 225 yards down. And with a limited flight, ball field, and anything that goes in that park is on a trickle. I mean, seriously, if the ball's gonna hit that bounce on the road, by the time it gets into the ski park there, it's not hurting anything. So that's my opinion. It's a long drive, and at the end of that drive, it's not hitting
the
bells.
Okay, so
Seen a land hit the pavilion.
Chandler and I will work with.
So for you patiently. I mean, there's always going to be big hitters, but I'm just saying, you know, for the most part, and that's why I brought up the point earlier that, you know, I'm just against spending money frivolously, and I'm in favor of spending money that's for safety and things, but we've had the golf course open for since 2004 or 5, whatever it is.
It's not 15 years.
We've not had any injury. I mean, this is. Can't foresee all injuries, but we haven't. Let's be real about it. So I'm just against spending money because it sounds like a good idea, but maybe it isn't.
So Chandler and I will work with Greg and Wade and whoever else we need to just go over all of these potential things that we've thrown out. Mr. Hardy is a binder. We've taken some of his ideas, incorporated into here as well. So I wrote down everything that I have, you did as well. If you have any other ideas in the meantime, please just email us so that way when we come back, we can have a discussion on it, everything that's been thrown out. Okay, let's move on to item number 13, which is a discussion on alcohol and history.
All right. When the Vista originally opened, we did not allow for events to serve alcohol in this room. And in 2013, that changed. We started allowing groups to, under certain conditions, to start to serve alcohol. They had to use one of our selected bars that we knew had licenses. They had to, they were restricted on their hours. They paid a greater deposit.
Becky's right behind us.
Oh,
she can add any.
Becky's here. Any questions? She knows anything about this. We have been asked by council members and mayor to evaluate the use of alcohol or allowing alcohol at certain events in this room. And we went back between May 2017 and September of 2019. There were 33 events that served alcohol in this room. And the fee changed somewhere in the middle there. The deposit changed a little bit, but at approximately $400 an event, between 27 months, there was about $13,000 brought in revenue, or about $5,000 a each fiscal year. So if the council were to decide that they did not want to serve alcohol and allow events to serve alcohol in this building, we would probably have to reduce the food budget for this building by $5,000. But Becky isn't here, and I will ask her if she'd like to come and talk about health. I'm not going to
try to
spot.
Is that $5,000 based on the extra fee that we have added?
It's simply the extra fee. It's not, that's assuming that in lieu of the alcohol event, that there's a normal event that's not serving alcohol. So it's just the alcohol.
But that's the revenue.
Correct.
So is there any associated expense to it that we're not
including? Let me get into that. So I came here one night with, I don't know what I said, but I was here at the same time that there's an event. It was serving alcohol, and it was rowdy, and that's why I brought it up with Becky. I had her start with Anna, and I brought it up there, and it was kind of spinning there. But the event staff has put together a kind of a cons list of what the side effects or the consequences of having alcohol being served here are. Is that you need to schedule extra staff, because we're not going to be one of our event hostesses here along with alcohol being served. It does typically require longer hours for that staff. There is additional wear and tear on the facility in terms of how the building is used, specifically with the floor here. You can see that this floor is, it's almost 8 years old, but it's in some areas it's pretty beat up. And it gets used a lot, but when the bar is going and the drinks are flowing and they're spilling, it creates quite a mess. There's been some nights when I know that the event staff has had a sticky mess on the entirety of the floor. You are more apt to have belligerent guests and clients. There's typically greater cleanup requirement after an alcohol event, which is in many cases ignored. Children are less attended to, and limitations or rules are violated by the guests and the clients. Since when I was here, if you've been at alcohol to this room, this building, I saw drinking in the parking lot. That's not to say that people still can't drink in the parking lot, but it was pretty open and it was pretty belligerent in terms of their attitudes. The pros of keeping alcohol events is that we do have the increased revenue. We are one of the few venues in our area that do allow alcohol to be served. We do expand the customer base in terms of more people are apt to use your facility, and you can run longer hours. Some of the stuff that Becky and her staff have already done to resolve some of these issues would be that the increased cost for the possibility of refund would encourage strict legal compliance, limiting hours that alcohol can be served. We've gone to bus people of our preferred bartenders that has an insurance policy, and that last call must be a half hour before the end of the event. One of the ideas that, I sat down with Greg and Becky and the event staff, and we talked about it, and there's not a consensus on staff in terms of whether we should forego this or keep it or what we should do. So I won't say it's split, but it's not, I wouldn't say anyone's too passionate one way or another, right? Okay,
I'm
saying that.
No, I completely agree, and I would say, you guys probably saw me during a work session doing a tour for Becky that came in late tonight, and specifically asked about alcohol. We might be the only one in the county that actually allows it anymore. Good or bad, you take that for what it's worth.
Yeah, take that for what it's worth.
So,
let me just add one more thing before we get into the discussion. When I came here that night, I was really uncomfortable with the way that we were handling alcohol events, in that I did see the belligerent guests in the parking lot, and there was, saw harassment occurring to other guests. I don't know what the backstory was there, but I just didn't like what I saw. And I thought to myself, we have an event staff here, but I don't want them confronting these people either. So the thought was, is either you have one of two options. One, and I don't think that keeping it the way it is an option. I think you either have to do one option of completely forego alcohol in this room. I think you honor the contracts that we have currently, but then phase out alcohol out of that. Second would be that you make it even more strict, that you require them to hire, the idea we had was that you require, get them to require hiring off-duty police officers. They come up here and get $150 a night to just patrol the building and make sure that the belligerent guests aren't in the parking lot harassing people walking in the building, that they aren't keeping the drink in the building where it's approved. And that would obviously be a cost that's passed on to the client. But those are the things that we talked about. So I've thrown it all out there. I don't know if there's a, I don't know what the council feels. I'm happy to answer the questions though, Aaron.
So I think Mike's the only one that's been around from when we started this process.
Probably.
The two of us.
Yeah.
So I know that I was never a fan of allowing alcohol in this building. My preference, honestly, would be to cut it for a variety of reasons. I know we forego $5,000 in revenue, but I think that we probably, that's easily offset by the expenses. I mean, maybe the expense of some of these things that are listed here are even higher than the $5,000 that we're getting at Oakdale. I don't love the fact that we're gonna be known as the only facility in Utah County where you can drink alcohol. And my biggest heartburn is that, as this is our community recreation center, I have been here multiple times where there's a wedding here and something else happening in the basement, whether it's youth theater or karate or whatever the case is. And so we have children here recreating while alcohol's being served upstairs. And if we have belligerent people in the restrooms, in the hallways, in the parking lot, I would prefer that we just make this our community recreation center and not have alcohol served here.
That's a great point.
I agree. I also think whatever happens here is one issue. As soon as those people get in their cars and drive out into the city onto our city streets, we have a bunch of drunk people driving in somewhere else. I'm not a fan of that idea, sending people out into the streets drunk. I have to disclose the fact that my daughter-in-law is a hostess here at the Vista Room, and she comes home and tells me horror stories and things that happen during events where alcohol is served. And I think, you know, we want her here being a hostess while these things are going on. She has been hit on by drunk men, 9 months pregnant, you know? I mean, there's no limit to what can happen, and it just worries me. There's been events where the bride, the bride's mom, the groom, everybody's walking around with a barf bucket because they're so stinking drunk that they carry their bucket around. I don't think that's the type of events we want to have.
That's really gross.
That's really gross.
That's our biggest issue, is just more concerned about the staff.
Yeah.
Because
it's
late at night and they're the only people here.
Right.
And we don't pay them enough to have to deal with that.
And it's usually young women.
It's young women. And yeah, I've had to lock myself in my office and call them.
That's not acceptable.
So, yeah.
Okay. So, and I question, it sounds like there's a lot of extra hours costs with the cleanup. Making sure there's enough people here. So I question what the actual revenue is, if it's $5,000.
I can speak to gross. Speaking of net, becomes much more difficult because
sure.
It depends on the severity of the event.
I
don't call that a Richter scale, but I'm just speaking there. There was one event where I know that the entire floor was sticky, and staff would come in the next day and they spend hours cleaning the floor, making it so that you didn't lose your shoes walking through.
I would speculate that the net revenue is less than $5,000.
Very likely.
If, just thinking, I like the comments that the council and mayor shared, but just thinking if we are the only one, then, or one of few, then there might be a great demand for that, and we can really skyrocket a fee with obligation to have off-duty officer, make it almost cost prohibitive to just the people that really want to do it, and we can make some good money off of it. I can't imagine it would be very often, but I'm just thinking, you know, what the market is dictating here. If we are one of the places and they really want that, they might be willing to spend a lot of money, which could turn an act, you know, a more productive revenue. But I think the problems are great. Cedar Hills is a community that is not associated, shouldn't be associated with drinking. Not drinking, I should say that, but the behaviors that the staff is experiencing. we're a safe family community. We don't want people them on our roads. We don't want our employees harassed. And whereas it's less than $5,000 a year, you know, I think that we should really consider changing the policy.
Now that 5,000 that Chandler's talking about, that's assuming that we would book that up still with another event, which for the most part we could, we probably would. So like, that's fair to say.
I agree that there's probably a market for it, but I think, again, knowing that we have other youth in our community here using the building sometimes at the same time, is there a price tag we can put on an interaction, a negative interaction, or we can say it was worth it because we made this much more money? I personally don't think so.
I'm sorry, have we had any reports or anything like that?
But it is an important one, and it does. They do frequent the restroom when they're drinking. Yeah. Happens. They do. They are.
So you have the pros and cons list here in front of you, and kind of staff's thoughts on it. We can go back and draft two proposals. One would be complete ban, another would be here's a comprehensive, and you can adopt one of them if that's what you'd like us to do.
I'm not significantly leaning towards not allowing it at all.
So you're going to say some staff time?
So I say one at a time? The reason being, it's all about safety for me, and it's been proven apparently that people can't manage themselves when they're around the alcohol. We've got a problem. I think if there's somebody else out there that sees the market for it, they can do it.
We will come back. What I'm hearing, we'll come back with a proposal to we'll rework the contract, show we're working with BTJ to show no alcohol events. We do have to honor the contracts we have been to. Which do we have any other company to ask?
Probably about 4 or 5-ish around there.
If any come in the next day or so, until this is adopted and moved by the council, we would honor those ones as well. This is something that I think that we can phase out in the next few months.
Would you plan on having it on the next agenda?
Yes.
Yeah.
I agree. I was leaning a little bit more towards being friendly to all of our residents of Utah County. I've been here a lot of times, and I've never experienced that. My young, attractive daughter-in-law worked here last summer occasion. I never heard any bad things about it, but I know, I trust Becky. I mean, she's locked herself in her room. I mean, that's scary. So I was leaning kind of what Brian was like, you know, I want to be friendly and open to our, you know, people that do drink. I personally don't drink, but I mean, it's an acceptable thing, and it's all legal and everything. I was thinking making it harder or at least protective, but I'm kind of leaning now the way to maybe just face it. I kind of agree that this is a community center. Do we really need it? The revenue's good, but you know, there's other things to spend it on, and the safety of our workers here. I'm heartened and I'm really disappointed to hear that story, but I mean, I really haven't thought about this.
It's terrible.
I would venture to guess, and Becky can tell me if I'm wrong, because I know that was the original intent, was to open it up for everybody in our community, but I would venture to guess that the issues that we're having probably aren't coming from resident nights.
I mean, you're not.
No.
Most are not.
No.
Sorry, one last question. Janet, how often do you guys call out and bring up all of us?
I wouldn't say a lot, but we've certainly had plenty of calls. I mean, not that I can count on one or probably two bands, whether it's from a staff calling because of an issue where they lock themselves in the office, or calls from the surrounding residents due to the, you know, the noise, the screeching tires, the fights in the parking lot.
I'll add a couple things. And in the past, I would call Lieutenant Ludlow before he left. You know there's a group coming up, you know they're going to be a problem. We let them know ahead of time so they can patrol a little extra heavy. And people are getting pretty good about calling Ubers and Lyfts lately, too. We see a lot of cars left here in the parking lots after alcohol events.
Okay, you have your marching orders. All right, that was the last thing on our agenda, so I will take a motion to adjourn.
I will do it again.
Motion made by Councilor Geddes, is there a second?
I'll second.
Second by Councilor Smith, all those in favor?
Aye.
All right, we are adjourned.